my name is Izzy. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. Thank you, Chris, for the introduction. It's really an honor to be here. I've told my story a couple of times, but never with a microphone, so I'm kind of scared. I was born in Arizona. I lived there for a couple months. I don't remember it because I moved when I was 2 months old. We moved to New Mexico. We lived in Albuquerque for like ages 1 through 5. And Albuquerque is kind of not a very fun place to live. There's a lot of crime, and I had a couple of things happen in my childhood that made me scared of life and scared of adults. And, you know, like a lot of us do. Before I go any further, I'm 24 years old. I've been sober for almost 2 years. I'll have 2 years in August. So I got sober when I was 22. And when I got sober, I don't think I thought that I was going to get sober and stay sober. I just, we'll get there. So anyway, back to Albuquerque. My dad was an engineer, and we moved around a lot for his job. He was always a really hard worker. He provided for me and my sister and my mom, or my sister, my mom, and me. And he got up at 5 a.m. every day and worked all day, and my mom was kind of like, my mom's in the program, so that was its own battle, and she just kind of accepted all of his work as something that she just deserved, and so I kind of did the same and just figured that I deserved to live a life full of comfort and ease for no particular reason. And we ended up moving to New York, and by that point, I was kind of used to moving, and I thought it was fun and exciting, and I kind of liked the idea of making friends and then leaving and then making new friends. And we moved to Texas. So basically, my childhood was good and normal. I always felt like, you know, like I wasn't the same as everybody else, but not in like a, oh, I'm so different and nobody could ever understand me kind of way, but more just like in a everybody has the secret to life that I don't have kind of way. And I just figured that I was missing something or there was never enough. I was never doing enough. And I started to, once I got into middle school, I started to feel like I should probably be on some kind of different track than everybody else. I looked around at my public school and everybody was kind of just like, and so I asked my parents if I could go to a private school, and I made like a whole PowerPoint about it, and I was really determined, you know, because when you really want something you make a PowerPoint. And then and I applied to this school. I wrote a whole essay. This was in seventh grade. And I remember they kept talking about how strange it was to switch schools in seventh grade. And I was just like, I really want this. I really think that, like, this is the right thing. I want to go to a really nice college. And I was always really good at school. I was always really sharp. And I got in to the school, and I was I didn't know because my parents hid the acceptance letter from me. And I found it, and they said, yeah, sorry, we're not going to make this happen, because they would have had to drive me. And I remember being really devastated, because when you're an alcoholic and you don't get what you want, it feels like there was a schism in the universe. Like, there was something that was supposed to happen. I felt it in my bones, and it didn't happen. And therefore, like, my parents are fucked up. Like, the school systems are fucked up. Everyone's fucked up. Because I didn't get what I wanted, what I really felt like was the right thing. And then when I was 12, my parents, my sister's best friend, her name was Claire, her parents divorced. Her mom went into this relationship with this woman who was completely unfit to be a mother, and her dad married this woman who didn't want Claire around because she felt like she would be a bad influence on the kids she already had, so Claire's step-siblings. Long story short, her parents didn't want her anymore, so we adopted her. And she lived with us. That was when I was about 10 or 11. And I always just thought she was really cool. She would, like, drive me to the library, but, like, we wouldn't look at books. We'd look at, like, the funny hats instead. And when I was 14, she died of a drug overdose. And I think I decided at that moment, I had, like a visceral moment. I was looking out my window, and I decided that, like, I don't care if I die anymore, you know? It wasn't that I wanted to die. I just decided that, like, any time a drug is offered to me, I'm going to say yes. And any time, like any opportunity presents itself to me, like, I'm no longer scared of the consequences. I'm just going to, like, fuck it, you know? And so I started hanging out with a completely different crowd of kids after that. And all of the friends that I had kind of stopped being able to relate to me because I just had, like, all of this dark shit to say, and they didn't really know what to do with it. And when I got to high school, we started experimenting with all sorts of drugs. I discovered Xanax. I thought that was pretty cool. I liked waking up with, like, a whole bunch of new things that I didn't know where they came from. And I thought that was great. I thought it was awesome, and I thought I was having a really fun time. And honestly, at that time, I was. I got high off of drugs and attention and mischief and stealing. And, I got high off of everything that I could think to get high off of. I would get high from starving myself or cutting myself or skipping school or yelling at my parents. I basically took this, like, oh, you didn't let me go to private school, fine, like, this is the daughter you have now, kind of approach to, like, teaching them a lesson, because I have to teach everybody a lesson. Like, that is my job in life, is to teach y'all why you're wrong. And I started just spinning out of control, and I was really upset, and I didn't know how to process any of the emotions I was having. I had this group of friends in high school that all did a bunch of drugs, and they felt like just like freedom to me. Like, any time that one of them was calling me, I just would get so excited because I was going to go get into some shit. We're going to go, like, go on a beer run and see what happens. Anything could happen, you know? And, like, I wouldn't come home for days, and I stopped going to school, and they thought that I was going to die. So they sent me to this, like, therapeutic boarding school, and I was there for, like, 2 years. And that was how I finished out my high school career. I was forced into sobriety for 2 years while I was there, and I wasn't ready to get sober, and nobody introduced the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. It was a bunch of therapy. So once I graduated, I figured, like, now I understand, like, my like weird daddy issues, and, like, I understand myself, and I'm not gonna fuck up again. And I started going to AA a little bit in college because I graduated from this, like, completely militant, structured situation where they told us what books to read, what music to listen to, what to wear. We weren't allowed to, like, have sex or anything like that. So when I graduated, I went straight into university, where it was like I was living on my own and there were no rules and I wasn't getting drug tested and I could do whatever I wanted. And so I was like, oh, fuck, I'm fucked. Like, I knew it. So I tried to go to AA, but I wasn't ready, and started drinking again. And I just kept like having what I called at the time relationships with men. Where, like, I would invite a man to come into my life, and basically, like, it would always be someone that was just worse than me, right? That way I could, like, I met this guy who was homeless once, and I was like, you should live with me. and he lived with me for a year, and he was, I, like, I'd always point to him and be like, you're worse than me. You drink more than I do. You wind up in ditches. Like, at least I wake up in my place. And so then, that didn't work out, obviously. But in my reality, like, he was my world, right? Like, we were going to get married. I was going to inspire him to, like, become a better person. And somehow that was going to inspire me to become a better person. And then we were both going to stop drinking somehow. And, like, everything was going to work out. And then he was like, I'm going to move to Virginia. And I was like, okay. So then I got really sad. And I drank and drank and drank and drank. And then I tried to go back to AA at that point because my drinking was getting really out of control. And I also, like, knew that if I went back to AA, there'd be, like, a whole bunch of men there. So I did that. And then I dated, like, 8 people within a month, and then I had to move. Because when you date in AA, what time is it? Okay, cool. Yeah, when you date in AA, things can get really sticky, and it gets kind of awkward to, like, show up to a meeting. And so I moved back to Austin. I dropped out of college. And the thing is, I had been prescribed Adderall at age 5, and I took it every single day until I was 18, except for weekends. And so at that point, I quit Adderall as I was dropping out of school and becoming, like, a spiraling alcoholic. And it made me feel really good about myself. Like, I was like, I'm going natural. I'm going to be natural. Like, and I quit college because I was like, this is a waste of money. You know, like, all my justifications of, like, why what I was doing was the right thing and, like, and it always kind of comforted me when I was doing something that other people would look at and think, that can't be the right thing. Because it made me feel like I knew something they didn't. Like, I had the secret. Like, I'll show you, you know? And I always loved a good underdog story. And I figured one day, like, someone was just going to be like, hey, you'd be perfect for this, like, $1 million job. Here's $1 million. And I was just going to, like, show everybody. I don't know. And I moved back to Austin. And I became a server, and I was working downtown and making, like, you know, more money than I probably should have been. And I was, like, stealing from this restaurant I was working at through this, like, buffet scheme that I had figured out. That's a lie. I didn't figure out. Some other dude figured it out. My ex-boyfriend figured it out. And then on that note, like, lying has always been the thread of my existence. When I was in middle school, me and my friend Darian would, like, dress up in these church girl outfits with, like, cross necklaces, and we would go door to door, and we had printed out these, like, fake cookie dough, like, order forms, and we were like, we're trying to raise money for homeless, starving, illiterate, you know, and we'd be like, oh, but cash only. And then people would give us money and we'd spend it on drugs. And that was in, like, middle school. Like, I had just always been about scheming and just going these dodgy, like, really complicated routes to get to things that I didn't even need and actually, like, made my life worse was pretty much how I rolled. And then where was I? Yeah, okay, so I was working in Austin as a server, and basically, like, I had accumulated at this point, I'd been to jail a few times, I had multiple DWIs, I somehow, you know, I was paying my rent every month, but I was in this completely shitty relationship, and I had one friend left, and I just basically didn't talk to my family. My entire family lives in Austin. They're completely wonderful, loving, supportive people. But, like, I had cut them out of my life because I was ashamed of who I was. And I knew it deep down. I knew that I couldn't go on living the way I was. But what happens when you're an alcoholic is that the all of the lies and all of the harm that you've done to other people and the shitty, foolish ways that you've acted the night before and all of that stuff, it chases you throughout your day. And I had to do what I had to do to get away from that. So I kept drinking. I started to just be like sitting at bars with like people talking about like sports or whatever like boring thing they were talking about, and I wanted to die. Like, I didn't want to do it anymore. I would just keep ordering fucking Well Tequila and fucking Lone Star, and like tried so hard to get back to AA, because I remembered from the past times that I'd been in AA, like hearing people talk about hope and change and serenity and like believing that that had happened to these people. And I was like, I think I need that. I think I want that. Like, that actually sounds really good right now. But every time, at this point I had totaled my car, so every time I'd like look up the bus route to get to a meeting and look up what time the meeting started, and I'd be like, okay, so I have to leave for the bus at this time. I'd like get ready, and then I'd wind up at a bar, like every time. It just kept happening. So finally I was like, you know what, like, it doesn't really matter if I get sober for the rest of my life, or if I just get a little break, or if I just do this to like look good for the court system, it doesn't really matter. I just want to go to rehab. And I asked my parents if they would send me to rehab, and they sent me to this recovery center in Driftwood, and I was there for 30 days. And I was one of the people who showed up like ready to work. I didn't want to do, they would do like, it was like a bougie rehab, so they would do like, oh, we're going like rock climbing, and I was like, why? Like, I want to work the steps, I want to get sober, I don't want to go rock climbing. And they'd have like groups, and like, I was really frustrated with the people in the rehab who didn't want to get sober, because I just didn't want to waste any time. I felt like I didn't have much time left. You know, like, I had found this window of time where I was willing and able to do the work, and that's all I wanted to do. I also knew that in 30 days I would leave rehab and I would be much more susceptible to relapse, and so I wanted to get as much work done while I was there as I possibly could before I had to step out into the real world with, like, boys and stuff. And so I left, and I went to they had like a sober living aftercare partial hospitalization program that I stayed at for like 4 months. And while I was there, so I'd gotten to step 7 while I was in rehab. I found a sponsor at the Westlake 8 p.m. meeting. She had long brown hair, so I asked her to be my sponsor. And it worked out great. And when she was talking, the thing that struck me was she would drive all the way to Driftwood, which was, it's like 45 minutes from Austin. It's not far from here, honestly. Like multiple times a week just to sit and talk with me. And she wouldn't even talk about herself. Like, we were just talking about me. And I thought that was crazy. She didn't ask for like any money or anything. And it really struck me that like, that is something, that's a concept that's so incredibly unfamiliar to me at that time, was just taking time out of my day to help another person just to do it. And I was like, that is so foreign to me. This might work. And she also talked a lot about God. I'm going to talk about God later. I don't really know what that means, but I'm going to do it. And she was saying things that made a lot of sense to me, and it never once struck me that maybe she was second-guessing herself. Like, when I talk to my sponsees, I'll be like, okay, what's the right thing to say? Like, let me think, my part, what would God have me do? My experience in this, and, like, I'll think things through before I respond to my sponsees, and I'm sure she was doing that too, but it never dawned on me, because it seemed as if God was just speaking through her in words that made complete sense and were exactly what I needed to hear. And so that was weird. And so she came out and did that, and then by the time I left, I was on step seven, like I said, and for some reason, this dude, David, who was, who was living at that aftercare house with me, he was like, we should do Whippets. So I was like, dude, yeah, because in my mind, it was like, oh, it's just air, and like, and when you're getting drug tested, it kind of fucks with your head, because you feel like if I'll still pass the drug test, like, did I relapse? And so we went to this, like, seedy motel, and we did, like, 100 Whippets. And then I was like, oh, I don't feel good about this. Like, I feel like maybe that was a relapse. Like, I don't know. I struggled with it for, like, a month. Like, I was like, should I tell people, or, like, is it chill? Like, I don't know. I was really scared. I was scared to, like, disappoint my dad or, like, whatever. And then finally, I was biking home from work one day. I had gotten a job at Whole Foods. I was biking home, and I just kept hearing the Serenity Prayer over and over and over and over and over and over, and I couldn't shake it. And I was like, okay, courage to change the things I can. Like, fucking fine. I told myself, and I told my sponsor and the rehab facility and my AA group or whatever, I told everybody I got a new sobriety date. I picked up a desire chip. So that was on August 21st, that Whippet incident. And yeah, and then my sponsor was like, well, honestly, like, I feel like the work that you've done so far is thorough, because otherwise you probably wouldn't have told on yourself. Let's just continue. She had me, like, write an essay about why I did Whippets. in which I blamed someone else. So anyway, I kept going, and I made a list of all the people I'd harmed. I will say that when I did my fifth step with my sponsor, it took 7 hours, and we sat, like, it was hot, and we sat outside because we were at rehab, and there was no privacy, so we had to sit outside because inside people were always, like, coming and going, you know? And it just seemed like, at the beginning, I was like, this is going to be, like, she's going to be so fascinated by my life. I was like, I've been through so much, you know? And she seemed, like, just so calm about it. She was like, yeah, selfish, yeah. And, like, I started to kind of get the memo. I was like, okay, cool. Like, I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm self-delusional. I'm prideful. I'm dishonest. I'm inconsiderate. And it just kept being those same things over and over and over and over and over. And I was like, all right. But what also really struck me about that experience was that she had done a lot of the crazy shit that I'd done, the kind of stuff that you want to take to your grave, like when you, like, lie about a pregnancy test or whatever. Just as an example. she was like, yeah, me too. And I was like, oh my God. And, like, she was like, did you put, like a pink positive sign on it and then, like, send it? I was like, no. That's great. I just said it was positive. yeah, so that was really heartwarming. And, like, I just felt like, I didn't know that I wasn't alone until I really started paying attention in these rooms. 'Cause if I wasn't, like, shittier than other people, I was better or smarter or weirder or somethinger. And once I got in here and started listening to people's stories, I mean, you know, I can't be the first person to have said this, but I realized that I wasn't alone. So, I did 6 and 7. Those are the ones where you, like, think about step 5 and, like get ready to, like, give all your, like, selfishness to God. And I didn't really know what to do, so I, like, got in the bathtub. And it's taken me throughout this whole journey to kind of really understand step 6 and 7, because they are going to pop up again and again and again and again and again. as you run into your character defects, pretty much it's the same character defects over and over. Like, I thought it would be, like, some, like, huge journey where I learned, like, all these different facets of, like, how fucked up I was, but really it's just, like, five different ways, and they just keep showing up. I don't know what to say about God. Like I said, I don't think that I really spend any time trying to figure that one out. I know that when I was drinking, all of my decisions were made surrounding how I felt and how you related to me and what would happen to me if... So, like, I was the center of my universe. I was the center of everything. And when you're the center of everything, it's kind of like you can do no wrong. And then what I kind of learned is that I had to learn how to center my life around something that wasn't going to drive me crazy. And that just being kind of God or whatever, something that's not me. So now when I make decisions, I have to think about how they will affect other people and how they line up with my values and how they line up with the principles of this program. And I kind of, like, I think about this, like, spiritual center, and I think, like, is this thing with me on this decision or not? And that sounds kind of, like, hokey or, like, ghost story-y, but that's what I do. And if it feels like God is with me, then, like, yeah, why fucking not, you know? And if it doesn't, then I typically don't do that thing. A lot of my recovery has been sitting on my hands, just kind of getting through minutes and hours and days, and that's not even necessarily just when it comes to drinking. That comes to just not making shitty decisions that I really want to make. Like sending a text or an email or stealing something. I really like stealing. That was really hard for me. that was hard for me. I stole for a while when I got sober. And I had to, like, do some inventory on that shit. And I don't know. Whenever I have problems, I mean, my sponsor is an extremely God-centered person, and I fully welcome that, because it's so different from my perspective, and she seems to have a different serenity than I do, and I want hers, so I listen to her. And she talks about this idea of getting all of your needs met through God, and then everything else that you do is for free and for fun. So basically, like, if I'm looking to another person to make me feel okay, like, even if that person did every single little tiny thing that I would want them to do, it's not going to be enough. I'm going to be disappointed, or they're going to smell weird while they're doing it. And I really have to, like, I have to turn to something bigger than me for that kind of thing. And, like, that's fine. Like, whatever, dude. That's so much easier than being out there drinking. Because, I mean, I always wondered, like, why I had such a hard time with this program. It's, like, 12 simple steps. Most of it's kind of, like, second level or second grade homework level assignments, you know. And then the rest of it is just, like, being open-minded. And like, does that not beat all of the bullshit that I had to deal with out there? But that's what being an alcoholic is that sometimes it's a tough decision. And I feel like I never made, like, a decision. Like, now I'm going to get sober. Now I'm going to work the steps. I feel like what happened was I thought about wanting to be sober, and I thought about deep down, like, and I was embarrassed too. I didn't want to be that girl who, like, disappeared from the bars and, like, where is she now? And she's, like, in an AA meeting. For some reason that seemed, like, like, really lame to me, and I wanted to, like, party on and, like, die an alcoholic. But something inside of me just wanted to get sober, and I feel like that was the first spiritual step I took, just wanting. And I feel like that's all it takes to kind of open that door for the spirituality to, like, enter your life. And once you do that, it's just a matter of continuing with the momentum. Or at least for me, it was everything just worked out. I oh my God. So anyway, step eight, I made a list, and I was really, step eight was kind of confusing to me. I felt like no matter how many times I read it, I was still kind of confused, because they were like, now that you've written your inventory, you have a list of the people you've harmed. And I was like, I don't see it. I don't understand, where's that list? Because all of the people I was resentful at, like, I hadn't harmed all of them. But I talked about it with my sponsor. I got a list. And then I started making those amends, and that was a really powerful process for me as well, because I really thought that there was going to be some kind of, like, limelight experience, you know? I think we kind of blow up the amends in our heads to be this huge, like, moment, you know? And if you're a normal person living your normal life, like, not suffering from alcoholism, and an alcoholic, like, wants to make an amends to you, like, first of all, it's probably a little bit confusing. Second of all, it's probably just not that huge of a deal. At least that's been my experience. When I make amends to people, they're just like, what? Sure. And I make my amends, and they're like, oh, yeah. Oh, also, you did this, too. And I'm like, yeah. And then it's over. And I really thought, like most things in my life, I thought they were going to be huge and about me. And like most things in my life, they were not huge, and they were not about me. And so that was a really humbling experience. And then I remember when my sponsor told me, like, you're ready to start raising your hand at meetings to sponsor other people. And I was like, okay. I started doing it, and I think I have one sponsee that's still sober. But I'm still sober, and that's the point. I have had to sacrifice things about my personality that I thought made me who I was and made me amazing. Things like pride. Things like I even thought that being inconsiderate was cool. Like, I thought being a bitch was kind of cool. And I thought it made me, not only that, but I thought it made me, like, unique. Like, that was a unique quality unto me. And I thought it made me appear smarter or something, or, like, sexy and mysterious. And I've had to sacrifice those kinds of things and not really know what's going to happen or what's going to fill those voids of personality that I thought were me. And what I've found is that the things that come into my life and fill that up and make my personality and make me me have been things that I didn't know I was capable of possessing, things like kindness. Sorry. I didn't think I was going to cry. Chris cries a lot too. He's probably crying. Yeah, things like kindness and honesty and appreciation and gratitude. And I have these relationships in my life now that are really genuine. And I have friends that actually know me, like the good parts of me, and appreciate that stuff about me. And I have a work ethic. That's pretty rad. I didn't know. I mean, I'll go to the bank and stuff. I'm, like, doing normal stuff. I live with my parents, because Austin is Austin, and it's pretty expensive. I just got offered a position at a rehab, the rehab that I went to, for October, which is super rad, because I don't know if anyone here is in the service industry, but it sucks. Especially when you're sober, because people are just rude to you all day, and you're just sober.
So yeah, so that's pretty cool. I don't know, and not only that, but now I see that, like, I can see that other people are working so hard to be the best versions of themselves, and that doesn't just, like, escape me, you know, I can actually see that in other people. And when you can like kind of get a grip on the fact that like other people have full-blown lives outside of yours, it really makes the world a more interesting, beautiful, fragile place. And yeah, dude, I mean, if you're young, like, that's cool, do it. Or at least try. Or not, whatever, I don't care. I don't know, this has really worked out well for me. Like I said, I didn't think I was going to get sober, I didn't think I was going to stay sober. But now that I have, I mean, the desire to drink... Once I realized that the desire to drink really wasn't there, there was nothing to stop me from believing that other things couldn't be taken care of by a power greater than myself, because I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't even want to stop drinking. I came to rehab not even wanting to stop drinking. And I thought that because it said the only desire or the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking, that like I was going to like ruin the program or like I should leave. Cause I wasn't sure if I wanted to stop, but I mean, out of all the things that are happening in the world, I think AA is one of the most pure, most beautiful things that there is. At least, yeah. Almost got political. We're not going to go there. So I'm really honored to be a part of this program. I don't know. That's all I have.